the Bible to the passage we read a little earlier, Mark's Gospel, chapter 2, from verse 18 to 22. When we read the Gospels, we of course read about the ministry of Jesus Christ, we read about his teaching ministry, and we read about his miracles. These are of course all found in the Gospels. And you find that his teaching ministry it falls under two categories. There is what you might call the teaching to his disciples. So there were times when Jesus quite obviously was with his disciples and he gave them teaching on all manner of things, on the kingdom of God and so on. So there was that kind of teaching ministry to his disciples. But then you will also notice that at other times, his teaching ministry was primarily in answering questions that those who didn't believe asked. This happened right through. I mean, what we're looking at here is an early part of his ministry. This is fairly early in Jesus' teaching ministry, and we find that these people have come to him, and they say to him, "Why do your disciples not fast? John's disciples fast, the Pharisees' disciples, they fast. How come your disciples don't fast?" So they had a question. And Jesus treats it as a good question, because there was obviously no malice intended behind it. They were simply asking the question. And you find right through the Gospels, these questions come again and again. It's actually very interesting that as the Gospel narrative progresses, the questions become more malicious. This is something you notice in Jesus' teaching. The early ministry, the questions were innocent enough questions. Look, the Pharisees' disciples fast, John's disciples fast, your disciples don't fast. Could you explain that? But then later, as the ministry progresses, the Pharisees began to oppose Jesus. And so they would say to him, for example, the Sadducees came to him right at the end of his ministry, in the last week. And they said to him, "Well, you people believe in the resurrection. Now there was a woman and she had seven husbands. And at the resurrection, whose wife will she be?" They sort of conjure up all these scenarios just to try and humiliate him and to trap him. But here you have these questions and Jesus answers them as they're given. Later, when he realizes there's malice behind the question, his answers change and they become more challenging to them. Now, the passage falls into two. It's a very simple passage in terms of analyzing the passage. The content isn't as simple to understand, but the passage falls into two. From verse 18 to 20, you've got his teaching on fasting. And then 21 and 22, the last two verses, he goes a bit broader, and we'll look at that in a little more detail. So there's two points that I want to bring to you this afternoon. And the first is about Jesus' teaching on fasting. Now, it begins with this phrase, "Now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting." There was this culture that had developed. We need to grasp this. We need to grasp the historical background to this. If we don't grasp the historical background, verses 21 and 22 will remain a complete mystery. They are some of the most enigmatic words that Jesus spoke, verses 21 and 22. If we are to grasp them, we have to understand the historical background. In the Old Testament, there was only one command for the Jewish people to fast. I wonder if you knew that. There's only one occasion when God has commanded his people, "On this day you must fast." I wonder, does anybody know what day was that? The Day of Atonement. Leviticus chapter 16. The Jews were commanded, "On the Day of Atonement, you must fast." It's the only day on which they were actually commanded to fast. Passover, they were not commanded to fast. Of course not. Passover was a meal they ate on that day. The Feast of Booths was not a command to fast. Any of the Jewish feasts and festivals, Purim and so on, and Sukkot, these festivals that they had, there was no command to fast. Indeed, if you go through the whole law of Moses, you start from Exodus chapter 19, where the law is being given. And you read all the way to Exodus chapter 40. You go into Leviticus, read the whole of Leviticus, including chapter 19 of Leviticus, with all those laws in there. And you go into Deuteronomy, where extra measures are given. You won't find a command to fast. It's very interesting. However, what the Jewish people did was that they had a number of practices that they added to the law of Moses. Now, this was not in and of itself wrong. There was nothing wrong in it. This is something we all do. We know what the Bible teaches, and we hold that to be precious and God's word, and then we have other customs, other practices that we have. For example, the word of God says that you must gather for worship. That's all it says, really, that you must gather for worship. Now, we decide that on a Sunday we'll have a morning service, we'll have an afternoon service. We decide our morning service will be 11 o'clock and afternoon service will be at 4:30. And the Word of God says that when God's people gather, they'll be singing, but it doesn't say what we sing, how many songs we sing, what instruments we have, and so on. So we have these practices, these customs that we adopt, and that's fine. There's nothing much wrong in that. And the Jewish people had done this. They had added to the law of Moses, and they had said to the people that it's a good custom for people to fast. So it had become a kind of a custom. It had become part of their religion. And as we will see in a moment, the problem comes when we lose sight of the line between Bible and custom. And what was custom becomes Bible. That's where the problem comes. And verses 21 and 22 are addressing that. So they had this kind of custom that the Jews would fast. They would have certain days when they would fast. And they made it a customary thing. And then comes Jesus. And Jesus is obviously a rabbi. He's a teacher. They observe him. They go to the synagogue where he's teaching. And he teaches with authority. We've already seen this, that they made this comment. He teaches with authority. He backs up his teaching with miracles. He's in this house teaching. And a man is lowered from the roof. And Jesus says about forgiveness of sins. And he says, I have authority on earth to forgive sins. And he says to the man, get up, take up your bed and walk. And the man does so to show that he is somebody with authority. So they notice that Jesus is a rabbi. And they say to him, you know, all the Jewish rabbis, all these famous teachers that we have, well, their disciples fast. All the rabbis say to their disciples, you must fast. It's a good thing to fast. Well, how come you don't? How come you don't say to your disciples, you must fast? And Jesus' answer to them is a very important one. He says to them in verse 19, can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. He says it would be inappropriate for them to fast. We need to understand from this what a wonderful thing it was when Jesus was on earth for those 33 years. All those Old Testament prophecies, all the Old Testament promises, all the Old Testament types and shadows were being fulfilled. God himself had come to earth. God himself had taken human flesh. God himself had come with the purpose of bringing joy to this world. When he was born, the angels sang to the joy, for the joy that he had brought. They sang to the glory of God. This is a wonderful thing that has happened. God has come. It's a little bit like when the Israelites were in Egypt and God raises up Moses, and Moses goes to the Israelite and says, God has heard your prayer. You've been asking for deliverance from this slavery. God has heard your prayer. And I have come because God has spoken to me in the burning bush. And God is going to come and visit this land. And God is going to remove us from slavery. And God is going to release us. And God is going to take us to the promised land. Now the people started mourning. Because fasting in Jewish culture is associated with mourning. Now, the people started mourning. Well, Moses said, what are you mourning about? I'm bringing you good news. Why on earth are you mourning? You see, because fasting was associated with mourning. You find, for example, Nehemiah fasted when he mourned for the state of Jerusalem. It was generally in the Old Testament associated with sadness and with mourning. And Jesus says to these, mainly to these Pharisees, Jesus says to them, you do not understand who I am, because they didn't. They thought he was a rabbi, he wasn't. He was the Son of God, and he had come to this earth full of grace and truth. And he had come to bring salvation. He had come to bring forgiveness of sin, cleansing from sin, adoption into God's family, all these wonderful blessings that salvation brings. Jesus had come. He had come loaded with blessings from the Father, and he was dispensing blessing upon blessing upon blessing. Why should his disciples fast? Why should they mourn? He does, however, please notice, he does say in verse 20, the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast on that day. Now, we have to understand this, that in the New Testament, there is no command to fast. However, because Jesus says this in verse 20, and also in Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, when you fast, do not be like the Pharisees who make a big show of fasting and have long faces and so on and go around telling everybody, hey, I'm fasting. Jesus says, when you fast, make sure that you wash your face with oil so that people don't notice it. He obviously expects his people to fast. And I would say it like this. This is actually quite simple. There is no command on anybody to fast. However, you may feel at a time of prayer, you have some particular burden and you're praying about some matter. Perhaps it's a matter in your own family, to do with your children, to do with your parents or something like that. Perhaps it's a matter to do with church life. Perhaps it's a matter to do with national life. And you just feel burdened to pray about this matter. And you feel burdened, I think I ought to fast about this. There's an issue in my family that needs much prayer. There's an issue here that I think I need to take very seriously. I think I would like to fast about this. And I would say to you, if the Lord leads you in that direction, please do fast. However, we cannot make it a kind of a church-wide rule that next Sunday we're all going to fast or something like that. We cannot do that. This is obviously something that is individual between God and each person, just as our prayer life is individual between God and each one. I could never stand here before you and say, tomorrow, Monday, you must spend 2 hours in prayer. You must start at 9 o'clock and pray for half an hour, and then you must go at midday and pray for another half an hour, and 4 o'clock another half an hour, and 8 o'clock in the middle another half an hour. You must do this. I cannot lay down a law for prayer. We must pray, but how we do it then depends on each one. And God sometimes lays it upon people's minds, upon people's hearts. I want you to fast over this matter. And there are others who never have that inclination. And that doesn't mean they're unspiritual, doesn't mean they're weak as Christians, doesn't mean there's something wrong with their walk with God, doesn't mean that they're not as spiritual as other people. There are people who just never feel, well, I think I want to fast. That's fine. There is no compulsion on anybody. It is purely an individual matter. So that's the first thing that is there in this passage that Jesus teaches about fasting. Now, what you find is that when people asked a question, Jesus would answer the question, but then he would teach a bit more. He would actually use the opportunity to give further teaching on the issue. This is something you find quite often Jesus does. And so verses 21 and 22, you have what I would call Jesus' teaching on the new covenant. Jesus spoke 40 parables. This one, verses 21 to 22, is one of the most enigmatic. It's certainly one of the ones that Bible scholars have argued over more than any other. It's very interesting. Most of the parables, 40 parables, most of the parables we don't have huge arguments about. You know, the Good Samaritan, or the prodigal son, the lost coin, the lost sheep. We don't really have huge arguments about. You read commentaries and they're broadly in agreement. There are two parables where there's an enormous amount of discussion as to what exactly they mean, and this is one of them. This parable of the new wine and the old wineskins. Did I say it the other way around? Anyway, you understand what he's saying. And he says in verses 21 and 22, no one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, and the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. No one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst, the skins and the wine will be destroyed, and so are the skins. New wine is for fresh wineskins. So there's actually two parables, but they're basically saying the same thing. He says, you've got a piece of cloth, and it's a new piece of cloth, and then you put on it a patch. And it's this unshrunk piece, but you put, it's an old piece of cloth, but you put a new piece of patch on it. And then you wash it. And of course, the one will shrink and the other won't, and it tears it up. And again, he gives the parable of the wine and the wineskins. What is all this? Well, he's talking about Old Testament law, Old Testament practices. And he's saying, yes, it's true that in the Old Testament you had certain practices. And he says, my coming has done something different. This is where this becomes so important. Jesus' coming changed everything. Jesus' coming actually ended Old Testament religion. If we pick out practices from the Old Testament and try and carry these practices into the New Testament, we are putting wine into wineskins that are not fit for the purpose, and we're actually destroying everything. Do you notice how he says that if you put new wine into old wineskins, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine will be destroyed, and so will the skins? Now, this is a hugely controversial issue. And I have to be very, very careful how I tread through this. And if I in any way say anything that offends you, can I say this to you? I don't intend to attack anybody personally. And I don't intend to attack any church or any Christian group in any sort of personal way. But I have to make this point that unfortunately Christians in the past have got confused about this. And Christians in the past have taken Old Testament practices and carried them into New Covenant worship. Please forgive me for using this illustration. I've thought about illustrations. I think this is the one that fits the best. Again, I promise you I'm not attacking anybody personally. But take the whole idea of the priesthood. Now, you know, in the Old Testament there was the priesthood. And the priests wore certain garments. And the priests had certain duties. And they had that label, priests. And as you know, there are churches today who've carried that into New Covenant worship. And they say, well, there are priests and they wear certain garments and they do certain duties. How do you get that from? You get that from the Old Covenant. Well, one of the reasons why I'll never call myself a priest, and please forgive me, but I'm never going to wear any garments, however many people would want me to, because the new covenant is the new covenant. There's a reason why it's called new. And when you read the book of Hebrews, the writer to the Hebrews says, the old has become obsolete. That's the word he uses. It's a very strong Greek word, and it means it is finished with. It is done. It is gone. It has served its purpose. It is no longer there for any purpose. And in the new covenant, everything changes, so all believers are called priests. And all believers are told, you have gifts. And all believers are told, you have a role to play in the life of the local church. We do not go back to the old covenant and take practices from the old covenant and bring them into the new. If I was preaching in Kenya, my application actually, interestingly, would be circumcision. Circumcision was something that is widely practiced in Kenya. All men get circumcised in Kenya. That's just African tradition. Now, even after they become Christians, after Christianity has come, and people have left their traditional African religion and come into the church and become Christians, circumcision still goes on. And you ask people, say, can you tell me where you get this from in the Bible? Of course, they go straight into the Old Testament and say, Abraham was circumcised, Abraham circumcised Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and so on. They were all circumcised. There it is, an old covenant practice. Now, Paul says to the Galatians, I say to you, if you allow yourselves to be circumcised, Christ is of no value to you at all. Galatians chapter 5. He fights circumcision. But of course, people, you see, want to justify their practice, and they will pull things like this. There is a broader application. We as Copse Road Chapel can't say, well, of course, we would never do that. There is a broader application, and in just a few minutes, I want to explain that. The whole danger, as I've said, is people have their faith, they have their religion, and they put on it a number of traditions. You see where I'm going with this? And so they say, well, we're Christians, and so our tradition is we do this, and we do this, and we do this, and these are our traditions. There's nothing wrong with traditions, except when we cling to traditions and we actually make them biblical and we say, this is what the Bible is teaching. Now, actually, if you examine Christian worship, you examine Christian living, really, the New Testament is very vague. I know this sounds a strange thing to say. The New Testament, you know, is very vague on many of these things. I already used the example of worship. When you look at worship in the New Testament, and you say, we want to know exactly what we do in church, the New Testament is very vague on it. Because God gives us freedom. God has given us brains. God has given us hearts. We love Jesus. And so we say to ourselves, our worship isn't going to be determined by tradition and men's methods. We love Jesus. We have brains. Let's use our brains to worship God. Let's use our brains to express our love to God. We don't have to be bound by traditions. Traditions become dangerous when they become binding. Traditions become dangerous when we say it is God's will that we do this and we continue doing it. And it just becomes tradition. Things like dress. Things like the songs we sing. Things like the things that we do in our worship services. I've often said at officers' meeting, I wish I was a courageous person. If I was a courageous person, I would love to see more changes and more changes. Because I think we need always to be exploring. And God rejoices in that, and God allows us, and God says, don't just be stuck on tradition. Explore ways of teaching, explore ways of worship, explore ways of doing service, of doing church, so that we're looking at different ways of doing things. Now, why should we be fearful of that? Why should we always say, oh, no, that's new, and we mustn't have that, because this is how we've always done things. Just because we've always done things in a certain way doesn't make it Bible, you know. New covenant is an exciting thing. A relationship with Jesus Christ is an exciting thing. To love Jesus Christ, that is what Christianity is. Christianity is loving Jesus. To love Jesus is an exciting thing. And to live out that love life with Jesus, to express our love for Jesus, to walk with Him in love, is an exciting thing. Those of you who are married, we're always looking for ways of having that freshness in our marriages, isn't it? When I was a married man, I was always thinking, how can I make sure that the romance is still there? And sometimes married people become impulsive. I remember once we were walking past a flower shop, and I just walked in and bought the biggest bunch of roses and gave them to my wife and said, I just wanted to tell you I love you. Purely impulsive. Now, there's nothing wrong in that. It's sort of the kind of thing that keeps marriage alive, isn't it? And our love relationship to Christ, expressed in our worship. How lovely it would be. And can I say this? I pray this week after week after week. Lord, unshackle us from any kind of tradition. Not because I despise tradition, but I think we have to see tradition in its place. Unshackle us so that we actually worship you with heartfelt love and worship. Imaginative and thought through and impulsive and yet honoring to God. There is that danger of purely bringing in tradition and following tradition, and that is what they had done. Fasting is a tradition. And Jesus says, we're now in the new covenant. And the new covenant is a very exciting thing. It is our relationship to Christ, expressed in our worship of Him. Well, I trust that has helped you to understand it. Not an easy passage, but I trust that has helped us to understand it. And I pray that God would help us to be that imaginative, unshackled church, particularly in our worship of Him.